and didn't quite get through it. It is a bit of a long chapter. And as we're going through it, we realize mostly this chapter is a narrative section that most of it doesn't require a whole lot of explaining. So tonight, as we try to cover a lot of ground, hopefully we're going to read and just make a few comments here and there to enlighten a few points. But for the most part, as we go through, we're just going to try and cover what's happening here in chapter 20, because it's a fairly straightforward account. And we've brought the map up here on the screen so that we can kind of get an idea of what the geography is that David is facing. Here, I'll point this toward me, Ethan, so that we can hear me a little better. Is it picking up okay? Yeah. All right. So you can see this is the southern part of Israel with the Dead Sea over here and the Mediterranean over here. This area would be the Philistine area, Aphek, Ekron, Gath, Ashdod, Ashkelon. These are all Philistine territories. This here in the center part is Israel. Okay, it's Israeli territory. And of course they go up to the north too with the territory of Ephraim. But most of the activity that we're reading about here in the beginning part of 1 Samuel takes place in the central part, centering around Jerusalem and this center portion of the land. So I'm going to zoom in a little bit to give us a little closer up view of these towns, because what we're seeing today is taking place mostly here at Gibeah. Saul is from Gibeah. This town belongs to his tribe of Benjamin. It's not far from Jerusalem, just a few miles, but this is where Saul established the center of his government. So he's been king for some 25, going on 30 years now, probably a little over 30 years by this point. So he's been king for a little over 30 years, and he has centered his government right there in Gibeah, his hometown. So this is where David probably has taken up residence, since he has married Saul's daughter. And he is in constant service to Saul. He's most likely living here in Gibeah. We saw last week that as he was playing before Saul and Saul threw the spear at him again, David went to his home and his wife told him, "You'd better get out of town. My father's really got it in for you this time." So he fled to Ramah, where Samuel is staying. Now Ramah is only 2.5 miles north of Gibeah here. So it's not a very long trek. If you were in a hurry, which I imagine David was at that point, you could probably cover the ground in about half an hour, 40 minutes maybe. So it wouldn't take you very long to run from Gibeah to Ramah. David stayed there for overnight at least with Samuel, and he stayed in the school of the prophets, as we looked at last week. And then in chapter 20, which we started to cover last week, David makes the trek back to Gibeah because he needs to see his very dear friend Jonathan. Now remember that Jonathan is a man that has shown himself to be of great faith throughout his lifetime. Several times he has put his life in the Lord's hands and attacked Israel's enemies single-handedly, almost. And God has used Jonathan to bring about some great victories for Israel. But also, Jonathan has displayed his faith by making a covenant with David. And it's a covenant to protect David, and it's a covenant that recognizes that Jonathan recognizes that David is God's appointed man to be the next king. This is a pretty big step for a prince of Israel to take, because Jonathan, as Saul's firstborn son, is next in line for the throne. If Saul continues and passes his dynasty on, it's going to go to Jonathan. So having Jonathan recognize that he is not going to be the next king of Israel is a pretty big deal for him. He recognizes what God's doing through David, and he made that covenant with David to protect him. And so David is going to take advantage of that. That's why he goes back to Gibeah. He needs to see Jonathan. David, verse 1, David fled from Naioth in Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my guilt and what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" So you can see David's extreme emotion here, which I can imagine most of us would probably be in a similar state of mental agitation if we found out there was They found out the king was seeking our life. Jonathan said to him, "Far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. And why should my father hide this from me? It is not so." So Jonathan denies the whole thing, says, "There's no way this is happening because Dad tells me everything." Well, Jonathan's going to be a little disappointed in the revelations that come out later in this chapter because he's going to realize he and his dad aren't quite as close as he was hoping they were. But that's his first argument. Dad wouldn't do this without telling me because Dad tells me everything. David answers that in verse 3. David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes, and he thinks, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved.' But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there's but a step between me and death." Now, David's probably not exaggerating all that much here with that statement, "There's a step between me and death," because, as we said, he went to Gibeah. Saul chased him there with three sets of messengers, and then Saul himself came to, Ramah. And then Saul himself came to Ramah, and David was only spared by a miraculous intervention of God, whereby the Spirit of God fell upon Saul, turned him into a prophet overnight, so that he lay on the ground in an ecstatic state and unable to pursue his designs of destroying David. That's what allowed David to escape. But again, even if David left the night Saul got there, Saul is only an hour or so behind David. So there's not much time between Saul and David. And so he's not exaggerating when he says there's but a step between me and death. And he tells Jonathan, "Look, your dad's not telling you because he knows you like me. He knows that you are on my side, and that's why he hasn't revealed his plan to you." So Jonathan acquiesces a little bit in verse 4. Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." We need to think for a moment as well about the relationship between David and Jonathan. Because just as there's some fallacies in picturing David as this little boy of 5 or 6 years old fighting Goliath, there's also a little bit of a fallacy in thinking about David and Jonathan being the same age. So let's think through our timeline just a little bit. Saul became king at about 40 years old, okay, and he has reigned now for 30-plus years. Okay, so when Saul became king, Jonathan was made commander of the army, which meant Jonathan had to be at least 20 years old, if not a little bit older. So if we take 20 to 25 and we add 30 years to that, Jonathan is now how old? He's in his early 50s. How old is David at this point? Okay, he's probably in his early 20s. If he killed Goliath in his late teens and he has now been serving Saul for several years, some time has passed, we can say David is probably somewhere in the 23, maybe 24 age range. David becomes king at age 30. And at that point, he's been running from Saul for quite some time. So we have David in his early to mid-20s, and we have Jonathan in his early 50s. So these two are not the same age. Jonathan is quite a bit older than David, and yet his soul has been knit to David, and he's David's closest friend. And so when he says, "Whatever you say, I will do for you," Jonathan is really making some statements here that he recognizes that David's the one that needs to be in control. David's the one that needs to be in charge of things. So, "David, whatever you tell me to do, I'm going to do." And doesn't that take a great deal of spiritual discernment to recognize that God's working through this man and I need to follow him? Even though I'm older, even though I'm supposed to be the next king of Israel, Jonathan's going to submit himself to David's command because he recognizes what God's doing in David. So, "Whatever you say, I'll do." Here's David's plan, verse 5. "David said to Jonathan, 'Behold, tomorrow's the new moon, and I should not fail to sit at table with the king.'" There would have been a sacrifice every month, and typically that would have taken place at the tabernacle, but as we looked at a little bit last week, the tabernacle has faded in its importance in Israelite society over the last 100 years or so, mostly because of Eli and what his sons did. Now, can you remember way back to the beginning of the book? What was Eli's sons? What were they like? Yeah, bad guys, really bad guys. I mean, they're stealing parts of the sacrifices, So, you could say they're embezzling funds from the in the form of meat from the tabernacle, but they're also taking advantage of the girls that were serving at the tabernacle. And their reputation was all over Israel as being men who were not worthy to serve as priests. And yet, Eli wouldn't remove them from the priesthood. And so that damaged the centrality of the tabernacle in the minds of many of the Israelites. But also, when the Ark of the Covenant was captured and taken away, that really damaged the centrality of the tabernacle, because the Ark was the symbol of the presence of God in the tabernacle, and it's not there anymore. And so the people have left off going to worship at the tabernacle a great deal. Now, they still do at some points, but they have also taken to holding some of the feasts that were supposed to be held at the tabernacle and holding them in their homes. And we're going to see a couple of instances of that. Incidentally, you can see on the map, way over here is this little town called Kiriath Jearim. That is where the Ark is at. It's been there for quite some time, since the Philistines returned it to Israel. It's been sitting here at Kiriath Jearim, and that's probably been about 50 years now. It's been sitting there, and nobody has brought it back to the tabernacle. For some reason, we don't know why, it doesn't tell us, but for some reason they have not reunited the Ark and the tabernacle. Okay? We're going to find out in the next chapter that the tabernacle, or at least there's a priestly city here at Nob, but we'll get to that. I don't want to get ahead of myself. So David says there's a monthly feast that Saul is going to be holding, the Feast of the New Moon, and he's going to be required, David is going to be required to be at that feast as part of his service to Saul. I should not fail to sit at the table with the king, but let me go that I may hide myself in the field till the third day at evening. So here's the plan. The feast lasts a couple of days, so they would have a very large meal in the mid to late afternoon, and it would typically last several hours. So that's after our fundamental hearts, isn't it? Having a potluck that just goes on for a couple of hours, and you just eat and eat and eat and play games and talk to each other. So he's David and Saul, they're good independent fundamentalists here, right? So, let me go that I may hide my... Of course, we've never had one that lasted 3 days or 2 days. Let me go that I may hide myself to the third day at evening. If your father misses me, and here's the test that's bound up in this. David says, I'm supposed to be there. I'm not going to go. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, for there's a yearly sacrifice there for all the clan. So here is the excuse for David's absence at Saul's table, that there's a family get-together. So much like Eldon and the Christens had 14 grandkids, huh? And cousins on top of it. Literally on top? Were there like wrestling matches? Or no? All those boys together, no wrestling matches erupted? You must have had them tied to trees or something, right? David says, I've got a family get-together, and tell your dad that I went to that. And we're going to see how he responds. Here's the test. If he says, good, it will be well with your servant. Now, why would that be the key if Saul says, oh, okay, good? How does that prove that Saul has no designs to kill David? Why would Saul want David at his own feast? Well, you can't kill him if he's not there. Saul wants to do this himself. Remember, he sent his servants not to kill David, but to fetch him and bring him back. When David's wife told the servants that David was sick, Saul told them, bring him here to me on the bed so that I can do this. Saul wants to have his hands in this mess. He wants to be the one to do this. And so if David is not present, then Saul doesn't have an opportunity to throw yet another spear at him. So if he says, oh, good, then you can be sure that it's well with your servant. But if he's angry, then know that harm is determined by him. So David says, if your dad's upset that I'm not there, it's because he wants to kill me, and this is how we're going to know. So, therefore, verse 8, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. See, David's reminding Jonathan of this promise that they've made to each other. But if there is guilt in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father? So David's bringing this oath upon himself, saying, look, if I deserve to die, I'm not resisting that. Then you do it. You're a prince of Israel. You have the authority to execute me. Just do it yourself. And Jonathan's response shows us that he knows that's not the case. Jonathan said, far be it from you. If I knew that it was determined by my father that harm should come to you, would I not tell you? Then David said to Jonathan, now we have a problem, right? Who will tell me if your father answers you roughly? So who's going to notify me? I'm going to be hiding out here in the field. And so if your dad answers you roughly and is upset that I'm gone, who's going to let me know that so that I can skedaddle? Because I'm going to need to split. I know he's going to be looking for me. So we have to figure out this last part of the plan. Verse 11, and Jonathan said to David, come, let us go out in the field. So they both went out into the field. So they're walking around in the field, verse 12. And Jonathan said to David, the Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. So he's calling an oath. He's calling God as a witness to this oath of what he's going to do. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if he is well disposed toward David, shall I not then send and disclose it to you? He's saying, I will tell you what's going on. If my father's doing well, or he loves you, and he's not trying to kill you, do you think I'm not going to tell you? I will tell you. Verse 13, but should it please my father to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also if I do not disclose it to you. So the first part of this oath is, look, if everything's good, I'm going to tell you. You know that. But if everything's bad, I'm calling God as a witness that I will let you know. This is Jonathan again covenanting with David to protect him. Not just from outsiders, but now from his own father. Jonathan is clearly placing himself on David's side against his own father because he recognizes that David is the man God has anointed to be the next king. Jonathan recognizes this. So when you read in the scriptures and they say, God do so to me and more also, you kind of have to read it with a, okay? This is what Jonathan's called. God do so to me. Sometimes we think maybe they would make some hand motion referring to being killed or something like that. But God do so to me and more also. If I don't fulfill this oath, then God will strike me down. And so he says, if my father's well disposed to you, if he doesn't mean you harm, then I'm going to tell you. If he does mean harm, I'm swearing to you, I'm swearing an oath that I will tell you. I will disclose it to you, and I will send you away that you may go in safety. I'm not going to turn you into my dad. No matter how my dad feels about this, David, I'm on your side. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. Verse 14. This is an interesting comment that Jonathan's going to make here. If I'm still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever. When the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. He starts this statement off, he's going to recognize a few things that God's going to do with David here, but he starts it off and says, if I'm still alive to see it. Why does Jonathan at this point think that he might not still be alive? Think about what he has just done. He's just sworn to go against the king, his own dad. That puts his life in jeopardy, doesn't it? Because we've already seen that Saul is not just angry at David. He sees David as a rival to the throne. And rivals to the throne don't typically fare well in ancient history. Every 4 years we have an election. And usually there's anywhere from, starting off at least, there's anywhere from 10 to 15 people that are putting their bid in to try to win that seat in the White House. And how many of them win it every 4 years? Just one. Not too often do the rest of them disappear after the election just for running against the guy who won, do they? But in ancient history, it was very common. If you challenged the king and lost, you disappeared, your whole family disappeared, and anybody that ever looked at you in a way that signified they might like you disappeared. Okay? Kings and tyrants are not very tolerant of challengers. And so Jonathan is recognizing he's taking his life in his hands again by partnering with David. So he says, if I'm still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord, that I may not die. Well, if Jonathan survives this, what does Jonathan know is going to happen? Eventually, David's going to become king. And so, again, thinking in terms of ancient Eastern histories, when there's a change of dynasties, what typically happens to the old dynasty people? Okay? They don't usually survive very long. So Jonathan is saying, David, I know you're going to become king. And if I live to see that day, don't cut me off. Don't kill me, because I'm on your side. And you know that. Show me the steadfast love of the Lord. But not only to me, do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever, when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. Now, who does Jonathan know, or is going to find out here, who are the enemies of David? Who's one of them? Saul, his own dad. Okay, so Jonathan's really choosing sides here, and he's choosing to go with what God's doing instead of with what his family wants him to do. And he's recognizing that when David becomes king and God cuts off every enemy, he's asking David to make this vow that Jonathan's family will not be one of the ones that are silenced in their opposition. Verse 16, and Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies. And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. Here's a tight-knit friendship. Verse 18, then Jonathan said to him, tomorrow's the new moon, and you will be missed, because your seat will be empty. On the third day, go down quickly to the place where you hid yourself when the matter was in hand, and remain beside the stone heap. So apparently out in the field there's a big pile of rocks. Here's how I'm going to tell you. I will shoot three arrows to the side of it, as though I shot at a mark. And behold, I will send the young man, saying, go, find the arrows. And if I say to the young man, look, the arrows are on this side of you, take them, then you are to come, for as the Lord lives, it's safer for you, and there is no danger. Here, well, here's the scenario, okay? David's hiding behind that pile of rocks. Jonathan's going to go down to the field, pretending to do some target practice with an arrow, and they would have a young man come along with him, and he'd be the arrow fetcher. How many of you do any bow shooting? Okay. Have you ever lost an arrow? Are they fun to find? No. What's that? Yeah, especially with the mower, right. So our kids can testify, when I do target practicing out here, very often I have to call them all outside and say, all right, I missed one. I was aiming that direction. It should be over there, but them goobers hit the grass and they just bury themselves under the sod so you can't see them. And so I think about getting, they have a knock on the arrow that flashes so you can see it, but I don't think it would help me because mine always seem to wind up in the gopher holes. I mean, way down in there. Yeah, there you go. Doesn't that let the prey know that the arrow's coming? Or I guess they're traveling too fast. It doesn't matter, right? So here's the scenario. Okay, Jonathan's going to do his target shooting. So he's going to shoot three arrows, and he's going to tell the young man to run and start looking for him. And if Jonathan says, no, no, come back, they're back here, then David's going to know that everything's okay. But if Jonathan says to the young man, but if I say to the youth, verse 22, look, the arrows are beyond you, then go, for the Lord has sent you away. This is how David's going to know it's time to run. It's time to get out of here. Now, why doesn't Jonathan just say, I'll meet you at the field here at 10 o'clock tomorrow night and let you know? It would look very suspicious, wouldn't it, for the prince of Israel to disappear, especially after we know that if Saul throws a fit about David's absence, it would look very bad for Jonathan to just disappear without any alibi. So that's why this ruse with the boy and the arrows. So there's the matter. Jonathan's going to shoot the arrows. If he tells the boy, you've passed them, come on back, that means David's supposed to come on back, everything's safe. If he says, no, 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 keep going, the arrows are farther, that's the signal for David to start running and get out of town. Okay. As for the matter with which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me. That's calling God as a witness between two people. saying, you'd better keep your end of our covenant, and I'll better keep my end of my covenant, because God's the one that's enforcing the penalties if we don't do it. Calling God as a witness. Verse 24, so David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. And the king sat on his seat, as at other times, on the seat by the wall. Jonathan sat opposite, and Abner sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. So they would have eaten this meal at one large table where the entire royal court would sit and eat the meal together, and David's assigned spot was empty. So it's hard not to miss David, or it's hard to miss David. Yet Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, something has happened to him. He's not clean. Surely he's not clean. And we know from reading Leviticus that there were a whole host of reasons that somebody could not take part in a sacrificial meal. A lot of things could make you unclean. Touching a dead body, touching mold. there was a whole list of things that could happen to keep you from being able to partake. So Saul, the first night that he doesn't see Jonathan or doesn't see David, is giving David the benefit of the doubt and saying, okay, something out of the ordinary has happened. We'll just wait. But on the second day, the day after the new moon, David's place was empty again. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has not the son of Jesse come to the meal either yesterday or today? Where's David? Why hasn't he been here? Do you notice who Saul asks first? You think Saul's on to something here? Okay, it probably has been very evident for a long time that Jonathan and David are good friends. And so when David is absent, Saul knows just who to ask. It's Jonathan. Where is David? Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, let me go, for our clan holds a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. So now, if I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away and see my brothers. For this reason, he has not come to the king's table. Under any other circumstance, this would be a perfectly reasonable explanation. Families had get-togethers all the time, just like that. Okay. That's why, you know, when we see some of you missing on Sunday evenings and things, we don't send out a posse to go locate you. We just figure, well, Eldon's here every other time the church is open, and so if he misses once, that's not a big deal. If he misses twice, well, then we'll start hurling spears at him, right? So I took mine home. I had my spear for Goliath over there, but we don't have it anymore, so you're safe tonight, Eldon. So he said, let me go. Perfectly reasonable explanation, and Jonathan takes all the responsibility on himself because he says, David asked me. So if Saul's going to get mad, we know where it's going to go. Verse 30 is the key. Here's where everything hinges and Saul's response to this proposition. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan and said to him, now this is some pretty harsh language coming up. Kathy laughs. Yeah, this is tough stuff. You son of a perverse, rebellious woman. So why do you think Saul goes off to insulting Jonathan's mom? Right. Hitting low. Yeah, he's hitting low here. He is a mean man. Yeah, and he is venting his anger anywhere he can. This is a very serious insult. You know, probably when you were kids, you had that experience. The bully wouldn't just come up and tell you you're ugly. He'd say, yeah, your mama wears combat boots or whatever the insult could be, you know. And that's not an uncommon thing to insult the mother because you know that's going to get somebody riled up. Don't you talk about my mama that way, right? And so Saul, which is kind of funny because who is Jonathan's mother? Saul's wife. Okay. I don't think I have ever yet insulted you if I was angry at the kids about anything. Yeah. Yeah, it is a serious, serious insult. And he's going to tell us why he's so mad. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? Say, you are embarrassing the entire family with your love for David. and your covenant with him, your commitment to him. What do you think you're doing? You know, we got to say that following what the Lord wants you to do sometimes will tear you apart from your family. Because not everybody follows the Lord. And sadly enough, that is true, that there are times when doing what God wants you to do will tear you apart from the very people that you're supposed to be closest to. We had a student at Appalachian whose parents kicked her out of the home when she said she had become a Christian. Now, we don't typically have to face that kind of persecution yet here in this country, but we can face a little bit of ostracization and some insults and some injuries and quizzical looks and things. But Jonathan really has chosen sides here against his own family, and Saul lets him know that in no uncertain terms. Verse 31, here's where we're going to see that Saul recognizes what this is all about and how serious this is. As long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Saul is confessing here. Though he may not realize it, he's confessing here that he knows David's going to be the next king. And as long as David is alive, there's no chance that Jonathan's going to become king. Now, Saul has already been told way back a couple of chapters ago that that his dynasty's not going to continue. When he didn't kill all the Amalekites like he was supposed to, he didn't kill all their sheep, Samuel told him, the Lord has rejected you from being king, and now your dynasty will not continue before him. So Saul knows he's the last one of his family to sit on that throne. Jonathan is not going to be king, but Saul is raging against this with such a vehemence that he's trying to resist what God is doing. And he knows it, because he says, as long as David's alive, your dynasty will not be established. Therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. He's a threat to our crown. He's a threat to our kingdom, and he needs to be put down. Jonathan, ever bold, not afraid to stand up to his dad, answered Saul, his father, why should he be put to death? What has he done? Now, this tactic worked last time, when David was first thought that Saul was trying to kill him, and Jonathan said, no, I'll go talk to him. And he talked to Saul, and he said, you know, don't sin against David. He hasn't done anything wrong. He's actually helped you, and he hasn't sinned, so you don't have any authority to put him to death. And that convinced Saul, remember? And he turned towards David again for quite some time, until there was another battle, and David was victorious, and Saul was jealous again. So, Jonathan's trying the same tactic that he did before. Why should he be put to death? What has he done? Verse 33, let's see if Saul responds here within it with the same sort of rationalism and tenderness that he did before. But Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him. Now, who's Saul trying to kill now? His own son. This is the insanity to which Saul's hardness has driven him, because Saul is refusing to submit to God's will. Remember, this is all about who's going to be the next king. Who has God chosen to be the king of Israel? And at this point, it's David. But Saul is refusing to acknowledge that. He's refusing to submit to that. And because he's hardening his heart against it, sin is driving him to greater and greater acts of desperation. So now he's not only going to try to kill David, now he's trying to kill his own son. So he tries to pin him to the wall with a spear. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. Yeah, it's pretty clear here. Jonathan is not walking away from this situation saying, well, I'm not sure. I mean, it could go either way, right? No, it's pretty clear. Saul wants David dead. And Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him. Had disgraced who? Who's the him? Could be one of two people. Could be Jonathan or David, right? Did Saul disgrace Jonathan or David? Both of them. Well, he did, but yeah, both of them. I think it's referring to Jonathan primarily here, because remember, who all's gathered at this table? All the leaders of Israel, the commanders of the army, all the royal court are there, and Saul just tried to kill his son in front of all of them. Saul just insulted Jonathan's mother and Jonathan in front of everybody. And so Jonathan rises up in fierce anger. Can't blame him for being upset about that, can we? In the morning, Jonathan went out into the field to the appointment with David. Remember, he said, I'll meet you on the third day. And with him, a little boy. And he said to his boy, run and find the arrows that I shoot. And as the boy ran, he shot an arrow behind him. So apparently, he sends the boy running and then shoots the arrow. This goes against most of our safety tactics these days. We tell our kids, stand behind the line of fire so that you're not in danger of getting shot. So, I know one time I was out shooting my bow, and Timmy came up to me and he says, hey, you want to play a game? And I said, sure. And I took the bow and just and shot it. And I said, go find that. He said, yeah. And he ran off. And that thing went 200 yards. And he ran off. And he came back a few minutes later with the arrow. And I found it. And I said, great. Go get that one. He says, okay. And he ran off. Took him a little longer the second time. And he came back. And I said, you want to do it again? He said, well, this game just kind of seems like I'm running a lot. That was funny. So, the boy runs off, Jonathan shoots the arrows, and when the boy came to the place of the arrow that Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the boy and said, is not the arrow behind you? And Jonathan called after the boy, hurry, be quick, do not stay. Can you imagine what David was feeling? The anticipation as Jonathan shoots those arrows, listening for what the command is going to be, and then he hears it. The arrow is beyond you. Run after it. Everything's as bad as we thought it was. You know, so David doesn't just hear the command to go fetch the arrows. What he hears is, you were right. David, you were right. My father wants to kill you. You need to run. You need to get out of here now. So Jonathan's boy gathered up the arrows and came to his master. But the boy knew nothing. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter. So Jonathan gave his weapons to his boy and said to him, go and carry them to the city. Now here Jonathan's going to throw all caution to the wind, because remember the plan was, you're going to know what is going on by the message I give to the boy. Jonathan was at that point trying to protect himself from his father, but notice what he does here. As soon as the boy had gone, he sends the boy back, and he stays. Out there in the field, he stays. And as soon as the boy had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed one another and wept with one another, David weeping the most. So Jonathan is again taking his life into his hands by being willing to be seen with David out here in the field. David had been hiding up to this point. And the message with the boy would have protected Jonathan if he had not seen David. But he's overwhelmed with his love for David and his faithfulness to David, and so he goes to meet him. Now, we men typically these days don't kiss each other too much. Who was that this morning asked me? Because Kim walked in, and I gave her a kiss when she came into church. And who was that? Oh, yeah, Don. Don walked up to me, and he says, do you kiss all the ladies that come in here? I said, no, just one. I said, do you want to kiss Don? Yeah. So we men typically don't do that, but you've got to understand how expressive the Hebrew people are of their emotion. Okay, they are a very expressive people, even today. In fact, one of the men that I am meeting with right now as I work on my ordination is of Jewish descent. And the guy better never play poker. Because you can't keep your emotion concealed. He can't. I mean, everything you say to him, he reacts with very vibrant expression on his face. And so these men are doing the same thing here. They're not afraid to express their affection to each other. They embrace each other. They're kissing each other. Now, understand, this is not the kind of passionate kiss that you would see between a man and a woman, but they would kiss each other on the cheek just to show their brotherly affection. David weeping most. Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, because we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between you, me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever.'" So Jonathan just tells David, "It's time to go. Just remember the agreement that we've made with each other. We're going to protect not only each other, but our offspring." And again, Jonathan's referencing the offspring here, I think, because he genuinely thinks his father's probably going to kill him when he finds out that he has sent David away in peace. Okay. And then he rose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. And so this section, boy, if this were a movie, this would be one of the most disappointing endings of a movie if we ended it here, wouldn't it? How many of you ever watched a movie with a bad ending? Yeah, okay. Occasionally it happens. Most of the time you like to see a movie with a good ending. Once in a while you run into one where the ending is just like, okay, what was that? Say, this isn't reality, folks. We make these stories up. Can't we make them end on a happy note? But this is reality. And sometimes when you're in the middle of things, it seems bleak, it seems dark, and it seems hopeless. And David probably is walking away from Gibeah in a very, very sorrowful state. I think I've mentioned one of my friends back in seminary. We were talking about some of the difficult times he and I had endured in our lives, and he said, "They're good times to look back on. You don't enjoy being in the middle of them. But when you look back on them and you realize you've learned something, you realize you were steeled, you were grown, you were matured through that process. You look back and you love what you learned, even though you hated going through it." And so David is not able to look back on this just yet. He's in the middle of a firestorm. It's hard to imagine even what he's feeling as he walks away from this, but it's got to be discouragement in the extreme, probably like none of us have ever faced. And yet, we can flip a few pages pretty easily in our devotional reading, and we can go up to Second Samuel chapter 1 and find out David gets crowned king. Hey, everything's going to be good. In just a few minutes' time, we can read from this point to the point where he's exuberant at being crowned king and God has shown his faithfulness. But at this point, right here, David's in the depths of despair. He's in the throes of anguish because everything seems like it's just being